Let's get into the Word together. We'll be in 2 Samuel this evening, chapter 19. 2 Samuel, chapter 19. So life is really messy. You know, it is. It's like, life is like your car when you have a lot of kids. It's, you just kind of have a hard time keeping up with it sometimes. There's so many things that go wrong, and the things that go right. Sometimes at some point in your life, when something goes right, you're actually really surprised, and you think, wow, this is awesome. Something went right. Most of us are, killing one bird with 10 stones instead of two birds with one. Most of us are feeling a little bit behind schedule much of the time. And sometimes we simply have to be reminded that through the entire situation, God has said, I will accomplish my will among you. I will do my work in the hearts and the souls of my people. And as we look at David's life, we're looking at the most undone period in David's entire life, the period in which he was being disciplined by the Lord. And yet, through it all, the Lord has been at work. Through it all, the Lord has been changing David, cleansing the nation, bringing up situations that needed to be altered in David's life and in the nation's life. And he's not finished yet. As we get into chapter 19, several things have happened. First of all, God has disciplined David, obviously, because of the Bathsheba situation. And that's why David's entire life was really in this turmoil. And the Lord had told him that this would be the case, that his life would be in turmoil, that he would lose the intimacy of his home life, he would lose the sanctity because he had done this evil thing with Bathsheba. But he wouldn't die, and he would not cease to be king. That the Lord would give him the ability to continue doing what he had to do, even under the discipline. And so in the situation, as it develops, we find that the Lord has disciplined David, but that David has been faithful all the way through the discipline. There's an old saying that what you need to do to grow is to hang on to God while he weakens you. It's an interesting way to view it. It's the situation with Jacob as he wrestled with the angel at Penuel. And the angel wrestled with him all night long and then lamed him, hurt him terribly. But Jacob wouldn't let go. He hung on, and the Lord blessed him because of that. And that's exactly what happens with David. David's under discipline, but instead of letting go of God and thinking he could get a better deal somewhere else, he says, Lord, I will hang on all the tighter. I will let go, as a matter of fact, of the kingdom. He left Jerusalem because Absalom had come after the kingdom, remember? And so he says, I'm willing to let go of everything, but I won't let go of you. And he makes it very, very clear. He's going to trust God no matter what happens. And even through some of his poor decisions that David makes, and I'm not talking about his sin with Bathsheba. That wasn't just a poor decision. That was a sin. But there's such a thing as a truly poor decision as well. And even through those, David says, I'm going to trust you. So God has disciplined David, but David remains faithful. Secondly, remember that Absalom has attempted a coup, but it has failed. And we saw that last week in chapter 18. The coup that Absalom tried to bring about failed. And Absalom, as a matter of fact, was killed. So Absalom tried to take over the kingdom, but it failed. And we saw last week that Absalom died. We'll see a little bit more about Absalom this evening. He had succeeded, however, in undermining David's authority. And this is very important for the rest of what we're going to cover this evening. He succeeded in undermining David's authority sufficiently that even after David is exonerated, and we'll see how this works, even after David is exonerated, he actually has to win the people back. And it is not an easy thing. Absalom had done a pretty good sabotage job on the people's minds concerning David's fitness for leadership. Absalom had undermined constantly without ever asking himself, gee, who hired David in the first place? Was it the people or was it God? Absalom never asked himself that. He just saw it as a political thing and he undermined David's authority. So even though Absalom's coup has failed and Absalom has been killed, there is still a huge amount of damage going on. And it was God who actually defeated Absalom. I want you to have a look at a verse, back in chapter 17 in verse 14. I don't know if you guys remember this, but in the account of how Absalom is defeated, the key people were the counselors, Ahithophel and Hushai, both of whom were serving in Absalom's court, but Hushai was actually serving David in Absalom's court. Ahithophel had advised Absalom to kill David immediately and go after him with some 12,000 troops. In fact, Ahithophel offered to lead the troops, and had he done it, he would have won. Absalom would have been the king. It would have worked. But Hushai came along and said, well, you know, I don't think that's going to work, and he planted seeds of doubt in the leadership's mind on purpose, because he was working for David, really. He wanted to buy David some time. These two counselors are really the main actors, but behind the counselors, God was at work. Notice in verse 14 of 2 Samuel 17, it says, Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. Look at the next line. For the Lord had ordained to thwart the good, or accurate is more like it, counsel of Ahithophel, in order that the Lord might bring calamity on Absalom. What I want to point out here is that the author here, Samuel, in all probability, or at least he was the editor, the author wants us to know that if you trust God, you must trust his providence. This goes along exactly with what we've been studying in Romans. You must trust that he's at work behind the scenes, even using fallen human decisions at times that are out of our control to bring about a situation that is in his control. It's very hard for us to grasp, because all we see is the people, and we tend to hate the people who say and do certain things, and it's all their fault and this and that, and forget that God is actually doing things behind the scenes. He still calls upon us to make decisions, even resist certain things or give our opinion or whatever the case may be. But we must understand that behind the scenes, he's at work. He had ordained first that Absalom do this because it was a discipline against David, and Absalom really wanted to. God didn't twist Absalom's arm to do any of this stuff. He just let Absalom do what he wanted. But he used Absalom's decisions to bring about the discipline, and then he used Hushai's counsel to bring about Absalom's fall, because Absalom had absolutely no inclination to follow God whatsoever. It's a good thing to remember that God uses evil people to accomplish long-term good sometimes. So simply the statement that I have been used by God doesn't necessarily give you any feathers in your cap, because God uses all kinds of people to do all kinds of things. The question is not whether has God used something I've said or done. The question is, am I walking with God? Do I care more about what he thinks than about what the world thinks? And in the case of Absalom, as the coup has been attempted and failed, the Lord was behind all of it. And the Lord let Absalom do this. We learn a lot about Absalom's failures, but really the providence of God is very clear in the passage. Third thing I want you to know, not only was David disciplined but faithful, and Absalom attempted the coup and then failed, but God had vindicated David, and yet David was crushed in the process. David won the war, you know, the war with the armies of Absalom. Here's David up in Mahanaim, which is across the Jordan River. He and a relatively small group of people have set up camp in Mahanaim. And over in Mahanaim, it's a walled city. It's a safe place. His allies had come to him. But essentially, this is this little island of support for David and much of northern Israel and all of Judah and Benjamin. Remember, Israel was sort of divided. Even at this point, there was a sort of a northern personality and a southern personality. Eventually, it erupted into a major civil war under David's son, or after David's son, after Solomon died. It was a major civil war between the two. But even at this point, the north and the south were sort of at odds. They understood, they were very tribal, and they kind of stuck together, the northern 10 and the southern 2. And the southern 2 tribes were, now note this, it's very important, Benjamin and Judah. And it was among Benjamin and Judah that Absalom had acquired most of his support over this period of time. So David has a political situation between these two groups. He has been utterly crushed by what the Lord has in his vindication. He's been set free in that Absalom has died, and the armies of both the north and the south who were under Absalom's leadership have been decimated and distributed so that they can't threaten David anymore. But despite all of this opposition and the fact that God has vindicated him at the end of this battle, David is crushed. Do you remember why? Absalom, my son, my son. He just can't get over the death of Absalom. In fact, it's more than just the death of Absalom. It's the fact that David had seen a lot of people die. It was the fact that this was his son who wanted to kill him. He would also, in fact, David actually had said he would rather have died himself than to lose Absalom. And yet that's what's happened. God vindicates him. He wins the war against both the north and the south with a smaller group of soldiers than either of those other groups. And it's a miraculous deliverance, and it's a marvelous time, but David is completely devastated by it. There would be other times in David's life where he'd have been absolutely excited. I've won another battle, but not this time. He's not excited at all. He's actually completely grief-stricken. All of the victories of his life mean nothing at this point. And I got to wonder if in the process of his discipline, this isn't a very important moment. David, all the victories of your life mean nothing in light of this. He, as we open chapter 19, David is weeping practically uncontrollably. People have brought to him the news that he has won the war. He's in Mahanaim, and the runners have come, as we saw last week, verses 31 to 33 of chapter 18. And David really doesn't care whether the war is won. He knows immediately that he's won the war. As soon as he sees just one runner coming, the guy on the tower sees just one runner coming. David's been in battle long enough to know that when there's only one guy running at you, it's good news. It means you won out on the front. Because if you had lost, all of your soldiers would be running at you and heading for the hills. Right. That's the truth. I mean, that's how they knew that. So there's only one runner. They knew it was good news, and he was running like a happy guy. He got there. But David doesn't ask him, did we win? David says, how's my son? How's the young man, Absalom? He calls him the young man because David really sees him not so much as a full-grown man. He sees him as a kid. And that's why he had told him, be gentle with the young man Absalom. Well, he wasn't that young. He was 30, which in those days was definitely old enough, and even in these days, definitely old enough to live a man's life, and had made it very clear, even threatened his father's life, threatened to take over the whole kingdom, did take 10 concubines, and so on. And yet in David's mind, he could never get it out of his head that he was just the little boy who used to play around his feet back when David was a young dad. And that connection with Absalom at that level is what destroyed David here. Not that we shouldn't love our children, but David never got past the point at which he had to treat Absalom like a full-grown man who was not walking with God. It's very hard, very hard. You know something? I don't have a judgment to make on it. I just am describing what David was going through. He said, how is the young man Absalom? Not how is my enemy, not how is the would-be king, not how is, you know, another warrior or commander of another. How's the young man? In his mind, he was still his boy. And when the runner said, would that all of your enemies were like this young man, David knew what that meant. He knew he'd been killed in battle, and he knew what that was like. And he could only imagine. Although he would not hear the details until much later, he did eventually, I'm convinced, hear the details of how Absalom died. When he heard that he was dead, he wailed. He just wailed. He turned around, went back into his house. Exactly the opposite of what a king should do. You'll notice in verse 33, the king was deeply moved, chapter 18. The king was deeply moved and went into the chamber over the gate and wept. What that means is, you know, the gates were just actually great big buildings, is what they were, with openings that went all the way through. And so there were like huge offices upstairs over the gates in the same way that we would build an apartment or an office over a garage with two entrances that go all, if you drive all the way through your garage and you had entrance on both sides, you had offices on the left, offices on the right, and offices upstairs That's how the gates were all built, so that they became the administrative centers. Well, he went upstairs in the gate. Instead of sitting down in the main gate in public and saying, thank you for winning the war, David went upstairs and simply grieved. And it is really heartbreaking. It is utterly heartbreaking. And even though we know that David is really to blame, I mean, he's the one who, through the sin of Bathsheba and the lack of training among his kids and so on, but it's still heartbreaking. I mean, you see a person whose life is shattered, even though it's their fault. You've just got to be utterly without compassion not to hurt with them. And I tell you, I read David's thing, and I really see why he was so grief-stricken. Well, it was told to Joab. Now, you remember how Absalom died. David had told all of his generals, Joab the senior one, do not kill Absalom. Deal gently with Absalom. Well, there was Absalom hanging by his hair in a tree, and Joab killed him immediately. I mean, Joab had decided ahead of time to kill him if he found him. He had decided ahead of time to disobey David for his own political reasons, and also because he knew that if he took Absalom alive, Absalom alive would always be a threat, and Joab knew it, so he just cleared the board, and he intended to disobey David. Well, Joab hears that David is weeping over Absalom. And this is how we enter in to chapter 19. It was told to Joab, behold, the king is weeping and mourns for Absalom. And the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people. For the people heard it and said that day, the king is grieving for his son. So the people went by stealth into the city that day, as people who are humiliated steal away when they flee in battle. Now, the author makes this very clear in verse 3. He wants us to understand that this is wrong. These people should not come back from winning a battle and feel this bad about what they've done. But as they walk through the gate into Mahanaim, they hear David wailing upstairs because they've won. And it's crazy-making for them. They went out there to win for him. They won for him, and their king can't connect with it for his own reasons. So they steal into the city, and they're humiliated. And the king covered his face and cried out with a loud voice, oh, my son Absalom, oh, my son, my son, my son. And Joab came into the house. Joab hears about this. He walks in. He hears this wailing. He comes in with his guys, and they're all, hey, man, we won the war. Isn't that great? And he hears this wailing upstairs. People say, that's David. He's wailing. Joab's going, where's the party? I've been doing this a long time. We always have a party after we win. And everybody's going, we're not having a party. David is wailing upstairs. He's because Absalom got killed. And you got to imagine a couple of them, you know, Joab had a whole bunch of guys who walked around with him, young guys he was training, and they all kind of must have stood there and looked at Joab. Someone says, well, did you hear Absalom got killed? And Joab's buddies look at him and go, yeah, we heard. And Joab, typical of Joab, immediately sees that this is not a good thing for the nation. That if David doesn't do something right now that congratulates his soldiers, he's going to lose them all. He'll lose their hearts. And they will think that Absalom was right because Absalom had already told him David doesn't care about you. Remember, that was part of Absalom's deal. Now, Joab knew that. The politics was very powerful stuff here behind the scenes. And Joab knew that that was a political thing. And he immediately realized with absolute ice-cold clear thinking. If you want counsel from a warm, loving person, stay away from Joab. Because he is icy, but he sees that actually he does see something of a truth here. And he realizes David cannot afford to grieve right now. He has got to get back to work because this is a crucial moment for these people. They must see him as a king, and they must see him as a king who appreciates him, or he's going to lose what few friends he's got left in the world. So he kicks the door in. I mean, who in their right mind treats David like this? Only Joab, his nephew. You know, they're all related. This is his, Joab is David's nephew. And probably close to the same age, but nevertheless, they're related. And so they've been fighting on the same side for so long. They knew each other so well. He came into the house. Boom. It says, David, where are you? What are you doing? Today you have covered with shame, verse 5, the faces of all your servants who today have saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives, the lives of your concubines, and by loving those who hate you and by hating those who love you. What he's saying is, you've covered them with shame by loving those who hate you and hating those who love you, forgetting who your friends are. That's what he's saying. Now, Jesus told us to love our enemies, but that's a whole different thing than what David was doing here. What Joab is reproving David for is having mixed up priorities. And actually, there was an element of truth in this. Now, therefore, and he presses the point, verse 7, therefore, arise, go out and speak kindly or encourage your servants. Because I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, surely not a man will pass the night with you. They won't remain your friends overnight. And this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your youth until now. And quite a bit of evil had. So that was saying something. He was saying this would be the worst possible thing that has ever happened to you if you do not get out there and deal with these people. Now notice about this rebuke from Joab. It's very interesting. You talk about messy life. You think of David and you think of his writing the Psalms and he's such a hero to us, you know. He's a warrior and he's like everything that people want to be. And there's more about him in the Bible than about anybody else. And it's just this awesome thing. And here he is at this incredibly low moment and a truly evil guy, Joab, rebukes him at this low moment, almost kicking him while he's down. What's going on? What's happening? Well, in this thing, this is actually part of the messiness of life, isn't it? We like to think of things in nice black and white things where good guys always do good stuff and bad guys always do bad stuff. And it kind of is crazy making when you find out a bad guy did something nice. You know, I remember when I found out that Adolf Hitler wrote really, really nice letters to his girlfriend. I thought, he can't do that. He can't even have a girlfriend. He's evil. Nobody liked him. And then you find out, actually, a lot of people liked him. And a lot of his friends were strong. They would go to their death and did to support him. It's kind of weird when it's not clean and neat and the good guys wear white hats and the bad guys wear black hats. It's not like life isn't that way. Life is a mixture of all this stuff. And what we find in the situation is that we have David, who's essentially a man after God's own heart, who has failed and who is now actually making a bad decision, being rebuked by a guy who, as far as we know, has no heart for God whatsoever, Joab. And yet Joab is actually technically correct. It was a rebuke that was needed because there is a time to put personal grief aside and get the job done. And in our world, which is a therapeutic world, have you noticed that? We have been raised in a therapeutic culture where the most important thing going on is how you feel at the moment. And so whatever, you know, everything else takes a backseat to how you happen to feel right now. And if you don't feel really good, well, then that's the excuse that you have for not doing your job. And, you know, actually in real life, that's not true. That's good for sappy movies and existential plays and, you know, romanticism. But in real life, where you got to work, sometimes in order to do the right thing, you have to put off your feelings, and sometimes you have to cauterize them. Because there can be feelings that you can have that are just like totally wrong, really evil. But they feel real warm, but they're evil. And you got to identify them, kill them, cauterize them. And there are times when you even have legitimate feelings. Grief, for instance, at certain times, and you cannot afford to have it right now. You got to put it off and do it later. And I know that that goes against the advice you get from our world, which is never put your emotions off. Always wear them on your sleeve, let your emotions do everything. And if I might suggest that that might not be biblical counsel, I know it sounds like heresy in a therapeutic world, but there are times when the right thing to do is to say, you know what? I've got more important things to do right now than wallow in my own feelings about whatever this happens to be. I've got a job to do, and I owe it to the people that are around me to do my job to the best of my ability, even though it's difficult. And to that extent, ice-cold Joab really had it right. He really did. And David needed it. And also, it was needed because David's feelings for Absalom had gotten really blinded him to the realities of how he had to be a king. And that had been a terrible difficulty. On the other hand, Joab was harsh and inaccurate. He said something true. But notice what he says. He blames the whole thing on David. How dare you grieve? We have won this war, and yada, 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 yada. And he's extremely harsh. He's totally unfeeling in the thing. And I don't think David forgets it. And we'll see why in a minute. Why there's good evidence that David, this was not lost on David. David received the rebuke, but let me point out that Joab was very harsh, and he is also inaccurate. He's leaving something out of the story as he tells David. What's he leaving out? What is it? He's the one who killed Absalom. Now, why is that important to this rebuke? Because David would not be wailing upstairs if Absalom hadn't been killed, and Absalom would not have been killed if Joab had not disobeyed a direct order, insubordination, which was Joab was known for. He was known for saying, forget what the commander says, I'm going to do what I think is the best thing for the nation. Sometimes, actually, you know, you look at it, killing Absalom made things much simpler politically, but it was a direct violation of David's will. And Joab, as he rebukes David, does not own up to the fact that actually the reason David's weeping is because Absalom disobeyed his orders. You know, it's easy to rebuke somebody and say, well, this is all your fault, you know, and not see, well, you know, actually I contributed to it. And that happens a lot of times in interpersonal relationships that are very intimate, that are very close friendships, like in marriage, where you can say, well, you know, you always react such and so, but it's and actually, you know, there's a point of truth in that. And that's nothing's messier than marriage. Nothing. It's true. It's wonderful. I'm happily married. You know, sometimes you guys think I'm not happily married because I'm very honest about marriage. I'm ecstatically happily married. But nothing's messier than married life, and this is how it gets messy. It's that we look at the other person's faults and we say, well, you know, it's your fault. You're right. And we conveniently overlook the fact that actually they might not be responding the way they did if we hadn't said or done what we did. You see what I'm saying? And so it's that way across the boards in interpersonal relationships. So watch the balance here. There's an element of truth for David. We saw what that is. But Joab is really quite wrong in much of his actions, many of his actions, and much of his thinking. So now, but David listens to him. Verse 8, the king arose and sat in the gate. And when it was told the people, saying, behold, the king is sitting in the gate, then all the people came before the king. And normalcy was established again, and it's a marvelous thing because the people are realizing, oh, it's a big sigh of relief. David's sitting in the gate. Oh, great. That means we can go and talk to him and hear what he has to say about the war. See, he was the guy who had to debrief everybody. He was the guy who had to say, you've done a good thing. We've won the war, and here's the next direction we're going to take, and put his grief aside and make it and, you know, be a leader. Well, as he did that, the people came to him and really sort of saved the day, and they stuck around with him. Okay, now, next thing that happens is verses 9 down to verse 15, David has to do some serious patchwork. And when you read the story, you tend to think, well, of course, David won the war. Everybody would know that. He would come back into Jerusalem. Everybody's on his side. Everything's fine. That's not the way it was. Had it been that way, he would have never had to leave in the first place. I mean, if it was true that everybody was on David's side, he would not be out there with only 2,000 soldiers and a handful of friends living off of someone else's money that he, Barzillai the Gileadite, had sent a bunch of money to take care of him. No, David had fallen out of favor with most of the nation. So he has some serious diplomatic patchwork to do, and that's what he does. And it says in verses 9 and 10 that Israel was complaining with you. They were arguing tribal quarrels about who ought to be the king. Remember, they weren't states. They were tribes. And the tribes were very loyal to themselves and suspicious of one another. And they were in these two groups, the north, which is always called Israel, and the south, which is composed of, and note this, Judah and Benjamin, but it's always called just simply Judah. It's composed of Judah and Benjamin, but it's always called Judah. That becomes very important in a minute. And then there's the northern ten, which is known generally as Israel. So you got Israel and Judah, meaning the north and the south. I want you to get that because as you read the Old Testament, it's very important to realize that that distinction is important to make. It's not Judah, and Judah and Israel are two different kind of groups within the nation. So anyway, in the north, Israel had fled each to his tent. That's because they were on Absalom's side. Everybody went back home. They thought, well, we lost the war. Now what are we going to do? I don't know. All the people were quarreling throughout the tribes of Israel. They said, the king delivered us from the hand of our enemies, meaning David, and saved us from the hand of the Philistines. But then he fled when Absalom came. But Absalom, whom we anointed over us, has died in battle. You can see the dilemma. So some of them were saying, well, then what that, duh, you got to get David back on the throne, you guys. And so they had this big political argument in the tribes up north. Israel, that's what this is describing. And we don't know how long it took, probably weeks of this. They weren't dealing with electronic communications devices, so they're sending groups back and forth, and what are we going to do, and yada, yada. Well, this is the argument they were having. Should we take David back? Because a lot of people didn't want to. And the people who mostly didn't want to were the people from Judah and Benjamin, among whom Absalom had made great inroads. So in the north, they finally got around to it. They finally said, okay, we will take David back. David then sends Zadok and Abiathar, who were kind of good ambassadors. They had stuck around in Jerusalem, but they were still loyal to David. And he sends them to talk to the leaders of Judah and Benjamin and try and get them to take David back. Verse 11, King David sent Zadok and Abiathar, the priests, saying, speak to the elders of Judah and say this, why are you the last to bring the king to his house, since the word of all Israel has come to the king, even to his house? In other words, the rest of Israel wants David to be the king. How come you guys are holding out? Verse 12, David said, tell him this, you are my brothers. Of course, that was his tribe. You are my bone and my flesh. Why then should you be the last to bring back the king? Come on, you guys, let's make up. Let's make friends. Let me back in there. Let me be the king. You don't really have a better deal on the... And they knew that. Verse 13, he sweetens the pot politically. Now watch what David does. This is all diplomacy from here, really pretty much to the end of, well, to the verse 39, which is as far as we're going to go tonight. This is all David's diplomacy. And the first thing he does when he calls him back or wants to get back in is he says this, verse 13, tell Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? May God do so to me and more also, which is what they always say when they're going to say something important. In other words, may God kill me if I don't come through with this. May God do so to me and more also if you will not be commander of the army before me continually in the place of Joab. See, Amasa was another one of David's nephews by a different sister. Okay? Zeruiah was Joab's mom, Joab and Abishai. Remember, and Asahel, who died earlier. But these are mighty warriors, David's generals. And these were the sons of Zeruiah, who was David's sister. Well, David had another sister. And she had a son whose name was Amasa. So it's a cousin of Joab, and it's another nephew of David. It's quite a family thing going on here. Of course, when you got the number of wives these guys had, everybody was related to everybody. So he says, I'm gonna fire Joab and hire Amasa. Amasa had been the commander of Absalom's armies. He was well-known, well-liked, and respected, and this is a political move in which David is saying, I will have your commander be the commander for the armies. Strictly a move of political expediency. He wants to get these people behind him. And so he says, have Amasa come. He's going to be my commander. But it's also something else. Fire Joab. And why would he want to fire Joab? Well, duh. Joab was insubordinate completely and had killed Absalom and had rebuked David openly. For whatever the reasons, and they probably piled up, David said, Joab's out. Amasa is in. Well, it worked, and it brought all the hearts of the people of Israel to David, verse 14. And he turned the hearts of all the men of Judah as one man. Boom. They all of a sudden said, we will do it. So they sent word to the king, and they said, return, and we will be your servants. That did it by firing Joab. David's thinking to himself, dynamite, I got rid of Joab, which I've been thinking of doing for a long time. I got myself a guy who's probably actually motivated to do what I say, which is a really good thing, Amasa. And I made friends with Judah and Benjamin by bringing Amasa in. And that it looks really good. Amasa's better check his retirement plan and his life insurance, however, because if you know the story, Joab has yet more to say and do about this before it's all said and done. So, but be that as it may, at this point, this looks like a smooth move, and indeed it is. The king then returned, verse 15, and came as far as the Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal in order to go to meet the king and to bring the king across the Jordan. Now, he comes down from Mahanaim to the eastern side of the Jordan River, and crossing the river, they didn't have bridges. Because, of course, the river got really big every year, and any bridge that anybody would build would be washed away anyway. So they had to cross the river. It was a serious big deal to get a bunch of people and kids and animals across the river. And so David came down with all of his folks, and he's on the eastern side. Meanwhile, because he had made this decision about Amasa and made friends with Judah, Judah came down, all the leaders and everybody, they came down on the west side. And what they're going to do is they're going to wade across the river. Everybody's going to get wet. Everybody's going to be muddy. Everybody's going to be doing this thing, and they're going to bring David across. And what we're going to read here takes place down here on the east side before David crosses over. And some people want to talk to David before anything else happens. Can you guess who might want to talk to David if you remember the story? Remember Shimei, the guy that cursed David on the way out of town because he thought David was finally going to lose? And he threw rocks at him and stuff. And Abishai, remember Abishai, who was David's henchman, said, let me go. Just take his head off. Really, it'll happen so fast, you know, it's okay. Let me just go kill him. And David said, no. Well, that guy's going to come back. He's going to want to talk. And he's not going to come alone. We'll see. He also needs to deal with somebody else. Remember Ziba? Who came, who was Mephibosheth's caregiver? Mephibosheth, the crippled son of Jonathan, who it looked like had been a deserter. And Ziba came and he said, yeah, Mephibosheth doesn't care for you anymore, and he's really glad you're on your way out. And David, in a hasty moment, said to Ziba, I'll give you all of Mephibosheth's property. Well, now he's going to come back and he's going to have to deal with Ziba and Mephibosheth, and they're going to each call each other liars. So that's got to be dealt with. And then finally, he's got to deal with an old friend by the name of Barzillai, turns out to be a really good interaction. So let's see what happens. This is continuing diplomacy. Verse 16, Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjamite. Judah and Benjamin. And also, remember which tribe was the tribe that Saul was from, the previous king? Benjamin. So there's some real deep-seated political and tribal animosities behind the scenes here. Shimei was a Benjamite from Bahurim, and he hurried and he came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. He had come down the other side of the Jordan, and they're going to wade across and talk to David on the other side, and then they're going to try and help him get across. Verse 17. But he didn't come alone. See this? Verse 17. There were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him. 1,000. Now, in warfare, the Benjamites were known to be crack shots with a slingshot. And they were very, very serious warriors. He's got 1,000 of them with him. And remember that David is thinking, he has just put together a very fragile political peace to get him back into Jerusalem. So here comes Shimei with 1,000 Benjamites from the tribe of Saul, there was no love lost really between that tribe and David's tribe and David's family. And so this is not just a simple little, you know, I got to talk to Shimei who hated me and cursed me and threw rocks at me. This is a political thing and a dangerous circumstance, especially in light of this new piece that David had sort of put together. And with Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, these guys are all in cahoots. They're all buddies together. And his 15 sons and 20 servants with him. And they rushed to the Jordan before the king. And they kept crossing the ford to bring over the king's household. See, they're going across to help and to do what was good in his sight. They're all, they're kissing up to David, see, because they know now once the decision was made for David to come back, it's going to be very serious. And they knew that they had sided violently with Absalom, and they weren't quite sure how it was all going to turn out. Plus, David has a lot to lose. If these guys don't go with him and they're well connected, there could be a civil war. So it's very tricky. Very tricky. So they come down and they're making really friendly with David, and they're swimming across the river and they're hauling stuff for him. And they're saying, you know, we're really sorry about all that bad stuff that happened between us. Verse 19, Shimei said to the king, "Let not my lord consider me guilty, nor remember what your servant did wrong on the day when my lord the king came out from Jerusalem, so that the king should take it to heart." Don't take that to heart. Please forget that. Just, you know, it was a bad day. I hadn't had enough to eat, and it was just, would you forget that? "Your servant knows," verse 20, "that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I have come today, the first of all the house of Joseph, to go down to meet my lord the king." Do you think he's telling the truth? Do you think he's really repentant? How many think he's really repentant? Really? This guy doesn't have any credibility in this room. Nobody thinks he's really repentant. How many of you think that David thinks he's really repentant? Did you read ahead? I hope you did. But here's David, between a rock and a hard place. I am convinced David did not believe that Shimei was really repenting. But Shimei was making a very, very clear statement of repentance in front of 1,000 warriors of Benjamin and in front of everybody else. What would it have been like for the new king to have one of the main leaders executed right then under those circumstances? Would that promote the peace that he's trying to build and this coalition among the leaders? Uh-uh. Now, on the other hand, Abishai works for David and doesn't have all the burden of trying to make everything happen correctly for the whole nation. So Abishai has the usual piece of advice. "Let me kill him." Verse 21, Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, answered, said, shouldn't Shimei be put to death? Can't we kill him? I offered to do this before. I want you to know I'm still available. He cursed the Lord's anointed. Now, incidentally, it doesn't say that you should die for cursing the Lord's anointed. You can build a case for it. But, Abishai's answer to everything is, "Let me kill him." Verse 22. And David said, "What have I to do with you, sons of Zeruiah?" He's thinking of Joab, who he fired. And now his brother Abishai, both of them ruthless killers, great generals, won wars for David. But boy, I tell you, you know, you don't want to have Sunday afternoon lunch with them. "What have I to do with you, sons of Zeruiah, that you should this day be an adversary to me? Do not buck me on this." And incidentally, the word adversary is Satan, Satan. That's the Hebrew word adversary. "Get thee behind me. This is, I'm doing something here. What have I to do with you? I'm not taking your advice. And furthermore, if you buck me on this, you're going to be in trouble. I know what I'm doing. And I'm not going to kill Shimei at this time. I'll get around to it later." Which he did do. He didn't actually ever kill Shimei. Solomon did after David died. But before David died, he told Solomon, "Remember what Shimei did. He does deserve to be punished. You do whatever's right as long as you kill him." Really, you can read it in 1 Kings. And that's really kind of what he says. "I know you'll do what's right and kill him." That's how he... And so Shimei does finally get executed, but not now. And that's a very important thing, and we'll get back to it when we finish up tonight. But he makes this decision. He tells Abishai, "No, you're not going to get to kill this guy." And he says to Shimei, "You shall not die." And thus the king swore to him. And that's all he said to him. "I won't have you killed." He doesn't say, "Oh, it's okay. I know you didn't mean it. And I know you really love me. And I know you really..." He doesn't say anything like that. He just says, "You won't die. We're gonna make nice. We're going to keep our nation together. We're going to make decisions we got to make. And you want to stay alive? Right?" And Shimei goes, "Yeah." And David says, "Fine, I want to keep the nation together. You stay alive, we keep the nation together. Have we got a deal?" Yeah, that's the kind of thing. This isn't a warm, fuzzy deal for David. It's a decision. But it represents something about David. I want you to keep it in mind. We'll talk about it at the end. Verse 24, now Mephibosheth comes up. Now Mephibosheth, remember, was crippled. And he couldn't walk, had to be carried, or had to ride a donkey. And Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. And he had neither cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes from the day that the king departed until the day he came home in peace. Well, this is months without bathing your feet, and this is a problem. And without trimming any of your beard or your mustache. Now, they didn't trim their beards anyway. They had long beards. but they could trim the mustache. And so what he looked like was a walrus after this time. And he smelled like one too, probably. And so it's very obvious that he's been mourning. What this means is, look, I haven't taken care of myself, and I've been mourning since you left. And it's obvious he has. He's not faking it. Because you can't make your mustache grow real fast overnight. You know what I mean? So it's really obvious to David, hey, if Ziba told me the truth about Mephibosheth hating me, how come Mephibosheth has such a long mustache and such long toenails? Because if it were true, what Ziba told me, that Mephibosheth hated me, he would have been bathing and he'd have been taking care of himself. He'd have been having parties while I was gone. And Mephibosheth comes and says, you're right. And you've noticed, I have not taken care of myself on purpose in mourning while you were gone. Well, then what happened? Verse 25. And it was when he came from Jerusalem to meet the king said, why didn't you go with me, Mephibosheth? Where were you when I needed you? And he answered, oh, my lord, the king, my servant deceived me. Ziba, see. For your servant said, I'm going to saddle a donkey for myself, and I'm going to ride on it and go to the king. But you notice, I'm lame. And he slandered your servant to my lord the king. But my lord the king is like the angel of God. Therefore, do what is good in your sight. What he's saying is, Ziba took the donkey, and I could never get to you. And you know, it's really weird, because we think to ourselves, well, you know, why didn't he just call him or something? We forget that if everybody in your household decides not to tell your friends what you want them told, and you can't walk, you're stuck. And Ziba ran the household, and he basically took off with all the goods and all the stuff, brought it to David, and made it seem like he was making a big present to David, and that Mephibosheth had you know, told David to go away. Well, Mephibosheth says, it's not true. He slandered me. Now, David has a dilemma, verse 28. Mephibosheth says, you do whatever you think is right, but I'm telling you, Ziba lied to you. All my father's household was nothing but dead men before my lord the king, yet you set your servant among those who eat at your own table. I know you gave me a good deal, and I deserve to die. I was only, you know, but you've been gracious to me. So what right do I have that I should complain anymore? I'm not complaining. You've taken good care of me, but I want you to know this guy lied about me. And the king said to him, why do you still speak of your affairs? I have decided. You and Ziba will divide the land. He goes back on Ziba, gives half of the stuff back to Mephibosheth. Now, you might be thinking, if you're Mephibosheth, you took away half my stuff and gave it to a liar. But that's not how Mephibosheth responds. And to me, this shows that Mephibosheth is actually probably telling the truth. David says, I'll give half of your stuff back to you. Ziba can have the other half. And Mephibosheth said to the king, let him take it all, since my lord the king has come safely to his own house. I don't care. Whatever you want to give me, I'll take. And that is a good indicator that probably Mephibosheth is telling the truth. But notice the dilemma David's in. He can't tell who's lying to him. And Ziba is a well-connected Benjamite. And David needs friends among the Benjamites. So David is stuck. It's a real tricky situation. So he basically splits the difference between the two guys. And fortunately, Mephibosheth is not in a position to fight about it. He doesn't care. But David gets by essentially giving Ziba a portion of this. So he's made his decision there. And then verses 31 to 39, his old friend Barzillai the Gileadite comes down from Rogelim. And they're still on the other side of the Jordan. They haven't crossed over yet. And Barzillai is 80 years old. I'll just paraphrase it. He's 80 years old. He comes down. David says, you have been my friend. You have supported me. Barzillai was extremely wealthy, had taken care of David at Mahanaim, sent all kinds of supplies from his big ranches up north. About 50 miles north is where he lived. And they had been long, fast friends. And wonderful to see Barzillai there. But Barzillai is 80 years old. David says, cross with me over the Jordan. Barzillai is 80 years old, looking at the Jordan. I don't know, David. You know, I'm an old guy. I don't want to swim the Jordan River with you. David says, come on, you can live in the palace. I'll take care of you for the rest of your days. Barzillai basically says, look, I'm 80 years old. I have a son named Kimham. Why don't you take him? I'd rather just go back to where I'm from and live out my days. And it's interesting how you get to a certain point in life where the pleasures of court just don't matter anymore. You know, Barzilai says, what do I need with that? You're going to offer me, at the age of 80, you're going to offer me something that I haven't already had and found it wanting. My life is back here. I appreciate it, David, but I'll just be nothing but a burden to you. And besides, one of you guys is going to have to carry me across this stupid river, and I don't want to do that. So just give it to Kim Ham. He's really anxious to go there and bless him instead. David says, okay. They embrace and part company in verse 39. A really neat passing there among friends. And now let's go back. What can we learn from the Absalom story? As we look at what happens here, I want to point out some things that'll help us, I think. And as you look through, when you read this, it's not obviously you're not going to do everything by example, because these guys all make huge mistakes. Like Matthew said, there's an awful lot of tension in here, and there's a lot of bad decisions that everybody makes. But it seems to me that there's at least four things that we can notice, and I'll just run through them quickly. If you're going to live in a really complex world and where a lot of things go wrong and it's not a clear black and white situation at all times, notice these things. First of all, you need the ability to evaluate your own motives, and that is something Absalom did not do. He did not evaluate his own motives. He had all kinds, in the Absalom story, what you see is a man is gifted in every way that everybody wants gifts today. He had looks, he had wealth, he had power, and he used it all. And hair, oh yes, had hair. And he had youth, which is what the hair comes from, yeah. He had all the stuff that everybody wants and everybody wants to keep. And what did he do? He became greedy and selfish and self-centered and arrogant and violent. He had all the gifts, never evaluated whether he was doing the right thing at any point along the line. You want to survive, the first thing you got to learn is to suspect your own motives whenever you're pushing your power. Always ask yourself, am I doing the right thing? And people say, well, I'm tired of always questioning myself. Actually, questioning yourself is not a bad thing. If what you're about to do has moral implications, then you need to ask yourself, am I doing the right thing? Not a bad question to ask. Absalom never asked the question. And learning to evaluate our motives is a vital thing to be able to do. David evaluated his motives and came to the conclusion he would walk with God and trust what God said at every point along the line. Absalom never evaluated his motives and walked away from God. Here's another thing you need to do. The ability to limit your personal loyalties. David's blind spot about Absalom is clear through the whole thing. And like Randy pointed out, if David had dealt with Absalom back with the Amnon thing, things would have been a lot different. Our personal loyalties, in fact, some of our personal relationships, depending on what kind they are, can be a huge stumbling block in our walk with God. And in our world, relationships are so glorified that we don't even stop in the culture generally, we don't stop to ask ourselves, is this a healthy relationship for my walk with God? And if the answer is no, it's not, then I need to not let this relationship in any way dominate my thinking or in any way change my direction. David, as godly as he was, did not realize that his relationship with Absalom had become so powerful that he could not tell Absalom no. He could not follow God, and it really, with regard to Absalom, and it really took everything else out of focus. When you have your focus entirely on a human relationship, everything else goes out of focus, including God, and that's dangerous. Learning to limit personal loyalties. And there are times when you have to see that there are many things in life that are easy to understand, but you still can't condone them. David, you could see how David could say, I see why Absalom wanted to kill Amnon, but why you can't condone it. And I can too. I can see why Absalom wanted to kill Amnon. I can see why David did not want to discipline Absalom, but you can't condone it. I can see why Joab killed Absalom, but you can't condone it. And that's part of the messiness of life. You see why, but just understanding why someone does something doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. Got to make that distinction. Here's the third thing, the ability to see a broader reality than your own injuries and your own needs. The ability to see a broader reality than your own injuries and your own needs. many people flounder in their walk with God because of an injury or a need that they have that they just never get over. And they interpret everything in life through that one hurt, through that one scar. To David's credit, even though he was rebuked by a terrible man, the fact is David said, "You're right, I have to put this behind me and I have to be the king." And he really came out and made some decisions as a result of that. The ability to see a broader reality than your own injuries, to say, "I will swallow the insult of a guy named Shimei." Why? Because I need to serve this nation. And I'd love to have Abishai go over there and kill Shimei. But I can't. Why? I have a broader reality I have to deal with. There's more to this than just me getting my way. There's more to this than just, you know, my feelings feeling better or me getting vengeance on somebody, as right as it might be, isolated from everything else. But this is part of a larger matrix. And learning to think that way as a Christian is so crucial. Think in a broader context than what's going on internally to you. And ask yourself, if for some reason in some area of my life I'm not getting my way, maybe the Lord has a broader perspective that I need to say, "Okay, Lord, you know, that's fine." I have found every time I have struggled as a pastor and thought to myself, "Well, but this ought to happen, you know, and Lord, well, why don't you do this? And, you know, why don't you let this happen and make this?" And at every point along the line through the years now, after doing it for 25 years, every single one of those, I've looked back to the Lord and said, "Lord, thank you for not letting that happen when I wanted it to happen. Thank you so much for saying no to me, because I now see a broader picture of what was going on. And if I'd have gotten what I wanted back then," see, so getting beyond, and David needed that, he really did, and he responded well to it. The ability to see a broader reality than your own injuries and your own needs. And this is the fourth one, the final one. Matthew brought it up. The ability to live decisively with ambiguity. The ability to live decisively with ambiguity. In other words, to be able to make decisions knowing you might not be making the right one, but you got to make one. And this is the Ziba and Mephibosheth thing. When David had to choose, he had no idea who was lying to him. Somebody was lying to him. He knew it. He knew somebody was lying, but he didn't know which one. And he still had to offer something. He still had to say something. And you know what? That is a great thing to remember. When sometimes you have to say or do something that you think is just simply the best thing you can do under the circumstances, but you're not certain it's the right thing because there's no way for you to know thoroughly. You just say, "Well, Lord, I'm doing my best. I've got to make a decision. I will make a decision, but there's a lot of ambiguity. I'm going to have to trust you." You know, that's still okay to do, and God still uses it. And in fact, if you want to survive in the world, you're going to have to make decisions sometimes and say, "I will go forward, even though I'm not absolutely certain, but this is the best I can do, Lord. Would you please honor it?" You know what? I think we're going to get to heaven and find out that even when we thought we had it crystal clear, we really didn't. And a lot of times when we were just doing our best to muddle through, we were right on target, because the Lord is sovereign, and he really cares about where our hearts are at with him. As David comes back into power, we'll see what happens. It's not over yet. We'll see in the weeks to come. Let's bow our heads, close our eyes. Father, we pray that your Spirit would grant to us the ability to live decisively with all the confusion, the ambiguity that's around us, by trusting your word. David, actually, though he sank very low, was able to come to the surface when Absalom was not, because of his walk with you. And we ask, Father, that you'd grant us this kind of wisdom as we look into these things, as we meditate about the things in our own lives that we have really so little control over, the decisions we have to make to move forward, not knowing precisely and having to trust you with everything. Thank you that at least we are in good company when we face these things, and that you have promised us that you will honor our decisions. We trust you, Lord, for all these things, and thank you for your grace. In Jesus' name, amen.